Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to the Education Is podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nicole Forsythe, here with my co-host, Alan Paterka.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you today, as always, Alan. And we are joined in the studio by Jane Grabowski. Welcome, Jane. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Jane, tell us who you are and what you do.
I'm Jane Grabowski, and I teach at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I've been there for about 10 years. I teach Fundamentals of Oral Communication and Public Speaking, the two classes that every single college student hates but needs for requirement purposes, and I've been teaching for over 30 years.
Fantastic. So we brought you here today to talk a little bit about attendance and student motivation and student buy-in to classes. So I've heard you talk a little bit about it, but tell me a little bit about the transition that you made in your class that really changed some of those problems with student buy-in and attendance.
About, 4 years ago, I think I just got really tired of trying to bribe or torture or glue my students to their seats. It just got to be really frustrating for me as a teacher, especially teaching the kind of course that I teach. Students think that they only take it because it's a requirement and they don't really want to be there. And so anytime they had any reason whatsoever to skip my class, they did.
What kind of bribery were you using at this point?
Food. Seriously, some of my old students would tell you that I had pizza parties on a regular basis to entice them to come to class. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm. And I think it was just always me wondering what else I could do to keep the students interested, to keep them wanting to come. And it got to be a very stressful situation for me because it's important for me that the students are there. But I found that I spent more time thinking about those things than I actually did about teaching the course. So it became kind of me. I felt like I was really putting together a comedy show, you know, of trying to entice them to be in their seats. So it just really began to occupy way more time in my brain than what I wanted to. And I just began to wonder if there was not a different way of doing it. And several years ago, I went to when we used to have on Martin Luther King Day, and we used to do diversity things or during dog day sessions when we actually had things that were interesting and applied to teaching. During one of those sessions,
these are professional development opportunities here at the college that mm-hmm. we'd like to
And I went to one of those, and Mike from, and you're going to ask me his last name, and it is gone from my head
Mike,
at this point.
Mr. Mike.
Teaches in math, and he's been teaching for a while. He offered a session on inquiry-based learning, and I was just intrigued. So I went, and as I listened to him talk, I pondered the thought that perhaps maybe I might be able to use that somehow in my classes. So I experimented with that a little bit at a time, and what I began to realize was that the more the students were involved in the learning, the less issues I had with attendance. And so over a period of probably 4 or 5 years, I just transitioned my whole class to now it's all inquiry-based learning. I do very little lecture in my class. There are very little, I mean, they have some in-class activities, but a lot of it is they work in groups. And what I have found is that the attendance for me is no longer an issue because they're willing to not come for me and they're willing to let things slide if it's something that they're doing for me, but they're not so willing to do that for their classmates. They don't want to disappoint their classmates. The other issue is that they know that the information that they're learning, they're going to have to use in the presentations later on. So the buy-in has become much easier with the students. once they get through the initial presentation and they realize how important it is, then they just seem to be so much more invested in coming to class and being in class and being prepared than before. And so that's what really led to the transition. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely, yeah. I remember it seems like that's such a common issue, and it's an unfortunate issue. We're teaching college students. They're paying to be here in some form or another. I can hear my parents in my head saying, like, oh, how can people not show up to class, right? Surely they must come and be motivated. And
but I think
it's such a true experience that attendance is a problem.
It is. And I think one of the reasons that it's a problem is, honestly and truly, I don't think they equate the money spent and how much they have to work in order to earn that money. Hmm. And so they just pay for it, and then they go. And they don't stop to think, if I'm taking a class that's $1,000, how many hours out of my life do I have to work in order to pay for that? And for a lot of them, it's a lot. But they don't stop to equate it that way. And they also, I think they don't really see school as their priority. It's not their primary focus. Their primary focus is whatever job they're working at in order to be able to pay for what they need to go to school. It's all crazy, and it's kind of all messed up inside of their heads. Not that it's their fault necessarily, you know? It's just that is the circumstance. People my age, not me in particular, but because I did not do college in the traditional fashion, but people my age, usually when they went to college, it wasn't as expensive as it is today. Mm-hmm. And most students did not have another full-time job. Or if they had a job, it was usually on campus. Because in the olden days, people didn't have cars. And so their life was very much on the campus and tied to the campus. And so there was just a different mentality. And now there is just, I think that they have a lot more stresses in their life than we did when I was in school. The things that they deal with, the information overload, I just think it creates in them a lot of stress. And so they have this full-time job that they need in order to go to school. So for them it's, if I'm called in to work or go to school, I will skip class and I will go to work.
Well, in some ways that makes a lot of sense, because they have work, may be paying for other things besides school.
Maybe their living expenses,
for food, right?
Sure.
And family and fun, and college is just one of those other things that they happen to be doing.
Right, that they're trying to do, and so I think that is one of the reasons why there is such an issue with attendance in college. It's not really because they wake up and they say, I'm not going to go today. I don't really believe that. I think that they have so many other things going on in their lives that they just get to a point where they just need a breather. And because they can't bring themselves to not go to work, because they know they need the money, then not going to class is the easier alternative.
Can you describe for me really quickly maybe what inquiry-based learning is?
Sure. I'll do it through example. Is that okay?
Perfect.
Yeah, okay. So inquiry-based learning is really dealing with, instead of a teacher standing up in front of the classroom and spouting out all of the information for the students that they need, it's really about the students discovering on their own what they need. And it's come about, I think one of the reasons that it started is a lot of research into diversified learning, the whole idea that people don't learn the same. When I was in college, it didn't matter if you were a tactile learner, a visual learner, or an oral learner. You went in, you sat in your seat, and you took notes. You read, you went to the lecture, and you took your notes. And that was, and then you memorized whatever it was, and then you went and took a test. And over the years, there's been a lot of research done that not everybody learns best that way. And so there's all different kinds of ways to get students to learn. So based on that whole concept of diversified learning, inquiry-based learning really allows that to happen in its natural form. My class is set up that it's broken down into three units, and I have overarching objectives. So it's like in some classes there may be silo objectives. You know, we're going to study self-concept and we're going to study perception. But in order to get the students to connect that, why is that important when we're looking at communication? The best way for them to do that is to find out for themselves. So inquiry-based learning is taking a question and discovering the answer to that question on your own. And I tell my students that there's not really a right or a wrong answer to the question. What's really right or wrong is the process that you use to get there. Are you using sound reasoning? Are you using critical thinking? And one of the things that I like most about teaching this way is that they come into my class thinking that they're going to study communication. But actually what happens to them in my class is they get a whole lot of life skills. They learn how to become critical thinkers. They learn how to do research, and they learn what to do with that research that they've gotten. How do I decide that this source is more credible than this source over here? And so they learn how to work in groups, because my class is taught completely, entirely in groups. They have to figure out how to work in groups in order to be successful. And that's my first unit that they deal with, is what does it mean to be an effective group member? So once they've done that, then they take that skill and they just build on it. So inquiry-based learning is just taking a question and finding out for yourself what the answer is. And for some students, it works because they get to talk in the groups. For other students, it works because they're reading about it and they're researching and they're bringing that information back. Some students, it works because they're just sitting and listening to people talk. So you have all of the different styles of learning in inquiry-based learning if you're working in groups, because not everybody in the group is going to learn the same way.
Other inquiry-based learning that I had heard about previous to learning about it from you, it had really been in the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk a little bit about, did you find other people doing it in humanities kinds of work? Did you have any struggles translating it? Because I know it can often be kind of a discovery-based, you know, pouring acids into bases and watching it explode. That's one kind of inquiry-based learning.
Right. While that is one kind of inquiry-based learning, it is the basis of inquiry-based learning. It's very much embedded in science. Let's do this experiment and see what happens. If we put these two things together, what kind of result do we get? The principle is the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that instead of dealing with acid and another kind of compound, they're dealing with concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? What do you need to be a competent communicator? And what is the difference between being an effective communicator and a competent communicator? Because we hear we want people to be effective. Well, no, really, when you listen to people talk, what they really want is they really want competent communicators. And so the students then, they get to experiment with that. So what if self-concept isn't in the equation of communication process? What happens if you remove that? And so then they talk about that a little bit, and then they say, oh, but that has to be in there. Because when you look at self-concept, you're really talking about the people that are involved in the communication interaction. So if you remove the whole concept of self-concept, then you're also removing the people. Well, you can't have that, okay? Right. So they discover that, you know? So it's like, oh, okay. And so they for themselves begin to, they experiment with things like that. But they're not just experimenting with the concepts. They're experimenting with, if I'm looking at this particular presentation and I want it to sound a certain way, what do I really need to put in there?
Mm-hmm.
So it is the same principle. It's if you're over here doing a scientific experimentation over here, when you're finished, most people are going to want to know, what is the thesis of your research? What's the foundation of your research? And what are the results? And can you show me the results? And they do the same over here. It's just they're dealing with abstract terms. Hmm. At the time I started doing this, there was nobody else on the liberal arts side that was working with it this way. And it was really scary because there wasn't anybody for me to talk to about it. Hmm. And it's when you are making the transition and switching your classroom from the traditional way of teaching to an entirely foreign way of doing things, obviously there's all kinds of second guessing and self-doubt. Hmm. And I spent a lot of time wondering if indeed my students were learning what I thought they were learning and if they were learning it as well as I was pretty sure they were. And
well, that brings up a good question. How do you assess the learners in this kind of a model? What's your plan for that? How's it going?
It's been trial and error. So for me, the whole way of getting there has been through inquiry-based learning, of, you know, trying different things, of starting with the hypothesis that this is going to work and then implementing it and going, oh, shit, it doesn't work. And so over the years, I've just tweaked it little by little, and I still do. I will still mess with the assignments if I want something else. The whole idea of having somebody come in and work with them in snippets on research and teaching them a little bit about research three times throughout the semester, that's new this year. And I did that based on having the person come into the class last spring and having the students say, that was wonderful. We really learned a lot from that. It was just really so much information to get at one point. So I do a lot of, when I'm evaluating the actual course, I have evaluations that I give the students and I ask them to fill out. And there are three basic questions, you know. What did you like best about the course? What would you change? And what was the one thing that you really didn't understand? But as far as assessment goes, I don't give exams in my class. And I think that that is an idea that has been hard for a lot of my colleagues to get their head around. But what I feel, the way I feel about it is that if they have a project that they're working on for the unit, and it's the end project, they can't do that project if they don't understand and have a master of the concepts. They just can't, because they have to stand up and talk about the concepts and talk about what it means, how they relate to being a competent communicator. And they have to substantiate their answer with quality research. So at the end, do I have a whole bunch of A's? No, but I have very few F's and D's. And that's largely because the students will weed themselves out very early in my course. They know right away whether they like my style of teaching, and if they don't, they leave. They also know that if they're not self-motivated people or if they struggle with that, they usually figure out and will go to their group members to have the group members kind of help them and keep them on track. That's the other beauty, is that there's a lot of peer teaching that happens mm-hmm. when I teach it this way. They're really teaching each other. And they will ask each other questions. I mean, I think if you've ever been a teacher in a classroom, you see that happen. I mean, you're up in front and you're talking and you're the one that has the information. But instead of asking you, they'll turn and go, what did she say? Da, 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 da. And, you know, it's like, yeah, and you're hoping that that student's giving them the right answer, but they're much more comfortable in doing that with each other than with me, with any teacher. And so that's another benefit, I think, of the way of teaching that way.
I like that, you know, you're teaching communication, but you're having them in small groups where they have to communicate with each other. In some ways, I mean, you're doing the science thing, as in their little group is a laboratory for communication.
Right.
And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Jane, but you assess students they give themselves a grade, they give their group members a grade, and then you give them a grade,
correct? Right.
And that all gets factored into your final grade. So it's
right. And that is them giving each other a grade is another new part. And that also comes from the evaluations that I've gotten over the last couple semesters, that the students wish there was a way to do that. And so I spent last summer kind of creating a rubric that is very guided so that they know if you are rating somebody as a 5, which is excellent, then here is what you're saying the qualities are, that they have. So they assess each other, they assess themselves, and then they get the group grade. There's an individual component in my class as well, but that individual component is really helping them build the foundation that they're going to need in order to do the group work. The first unit, when they're actually learning about what does it mean to be an effective group member, we look at things like conflict and hidden agendas and roles and norms within groups. And it's so amazing to watch them, because the very first thing that I have them do when they get into a group is to discuss norms. How are you going to handle attendance in your group? How are you going to hold each other accountable and that kind of thing? And it's very interesting, because at the end of that time, there's usually like just 2 or 3 things that they have written down. But as they go through the process, when they get into the next unit, then they have like a whole list of norms and they make everybody sign it. That is, for me, that is a really good way to learn. Because they've tried it, and this way didn't work, and I've learned a lot about, yeah, when she says we need to do this, yeah, we really need to do this. And there are some things that you can talk and talk and talk, and they just have to find out for themselves. So to watch the growth is also one of the most rewarding things for me. There's a point early in the semester, in the fall, where I just sit and shake my head and think, oh God, this is horrible. They're not learning a thing. And then they stand up to give their presentation and it's like, oh my God, this is great. This is really good. You know, and they've had to struggle. Last year, I had a group who was very close to just disintegrating. They had 2 really strong personalities within the group, and their conflict between those two was absolutely huge. And the rest of the group couldn't move. They could not move them, and the group couldn't move forward. And they were just... And I thought they were going to disintegrate. So I intervened, and we went and we talked. And what I had them do was to focus on the concepts that we had been studying about group. And where did they see the conflict, and what kind of conflict did they see that was happening within their group and whatever. And that group turned out to be, by the end of the semester, one of the best groups that I've ever had. And one of the guys that was in the group had come to me shortly before I intervened and said, I think I need to drop the course because I just can't function in this group. And he happened to be one of the strong personalities that was creating an issue for the whole group. And, of course, he didn't see that. At the time, he was pretty sure it was this woman over here that was just very strong, and if she would just be quiet, and things wouldn't always have to be her way, and all that kind of stuff, you know. And at the end of the semester, he told me, he said, you know what? He said, I learned more from this class than I have learned from a lot of classes. And he said, this stuff, it's life stuff. I know how to make this work now, and I'm really glad that you didn't let me drop the class. Well, it wouldn't matter how many days I spent trying to prepare a lesson. Mm-hmm. I could never get it to be as successful as that was. And inquiry-based learning allows those things to happen, but it's really scary.
So it sounds like, you know, in your classroom before, there's a certain level of control with your lectures and you presenting information and them returning it to you. And it's really a relationship of you to student, student to you. Doesn't always necessarily acknowledge the group and the shared experience of working with one another. So what did it feel like before you went inquiry? And then, I mean, how does it feel to give up control?
I just said it's scary, mm-hmm. and that is the scariest thing. You have to be willing to not have the control. You have to be willing to fail, and you have to be willing to risk, and you have to be willing to know it's okay for the students to not learn everything. Mm. And you also have to be willing to hold them accountable for their learning.
Did you know these things before you went into inquiry teaching?
No.
Okay.
No. No. I can remember thinking early on when I was teaching, one of the things that I would stress about was, I have all this information and I only have 50 minutes to give it to them. How am I going to do that? Thinking in my head that I was the conduit, and it was me or nothing. And nothing could be further from the truth when it comes to teaching and to learning, especially now, in our culture now, where at the touch of a button on their fingertips, they can Google and find out anything that they want to know. It's just, and so... that was my first thing, was to realize that I didn't have to give them all the information, that it really would be okay if they understood about self-concept in my class and knew how it fit into the process, but maybe they never found out about the Johari window, which, of course, you don't really know that, but what I'm talking about. But that's a tiny little piece, when we're talking about it. So that's the first thing, is changing my attitude and being okay with it. One of the other things that's a hard adjustment is most of the work that I do for my class to get my class ready is all done up front. So my summers are kind of crazy because I'm looking at the whole semester and tweaking and figuring out if I want to make some changes and what I want to do. But once the semester actually starts, there's a lot I'm not doing because, and that sounds horrible, but what it really does is it really then allows me to observe what's happening in class. It allows me to really watch the students and to be part of the group from a distance and to see what's working and what isn't working. And I have a sticky notepad usually with me all the time, and I make myself a note and stick it on my notebook that, I want to change this activity. And before, I was so much guiding the activity that I really didn't have time to observe whether or not it was really working. So I like that piece. There was something else that you had talked about that I wanted to address. Was it... giving up the control is really scary, and being willing to fail is huge because it's just a whole different way of thinking. You really have to look at the whole idea of teaching very differently. And so to give up the control of the classroom, somebody walked into my classroom on a given day, they would think that there was nothing but chaos going on, when in actuality, that's usually when there's a lot of learning happening. I also tell my students that I'm very much a facilitator and not the instructor. And so it's interesting to watch, because the very first time I put to them a question about a particular assignment, I may say to them something like this. Okay, I've designed this assignment to be this way. So take a look at it, see what you think, come back to class, and if you want to change it up, we'll change it up. At first, they're not really sure. They think they don't have the qualifications to make that judgment. But then as the semester goes on, then they get kind of mouthy. Miss G, do we have to do it this way? We'd really kind of like to work this way instead of that way, So you have to be willing to say, okay, we'll try it. Let's try it. Let's see, and give them ownership. And I think that can be really scary for a lot of instructors. Giving up the ownership and giving it to the students, because most of us are raised to think that they can't have ownership because they don't know the information. Well, no, they don't know the information, but they can have ownership over how they learn the information. And that for me is that's the thing. They're not really telling me what to do in class. they're just saying, could we maybe instead of doing it that way, could we do it this way? Mm-hmm. You know, and why not? Sure, let's try it. Here's an example. usually with the first exam that they have, it's a take-home. It's not really an exam, but it's they're doing a movie analysis and applying the concepts that they've been studying to the movie that they watch. And so usually I give that to them. They do it, and they do miserably on it, and then they get the opportunity to redo it. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that what, but they don't know that they're going to get the opportunity to redo it. But so I will. So I put that out there to them, and then the question that comes up usually is: so when we get this back, are you taking the better grade, or what is what are you doing? Well, I say to them, what would you like to do? Do you want me to replace this grade, or do you want me to average the two grades together? Which would you like to do? Well, then there's this discussion in class about what are the advantages and the disadvantages that they have. They're not talking to me. They're talking to each other. And then they usually come to some kind of consensus. So some of my classes, they decide they want me to average the two because they feel that that's the fairest thing. My other classes say, well, if you take the better of the grade, then that's really reflecting the work that I've done. So, I don't do the same for all of my classes. Hmm. So,
At the community college level here, we talk so much about lifelong learning and setting students up for success. And as librarians, that's what we, teaching research is really, if you can research something in public speaking, surely you can research other things in your life. And it just sounds to me like these are kind of lifelong learning skills, how to teach yourself how to be in a group, practice being in a group, teaching yourself how to learn, teaching yourself how to create meaning, right. Teaching yourself how to govern. I mean, right, if we live in a democracy where there's a contract of the governed with the governing, In a very small laboratory-ish way, just as I listen to you talk, that's kind of where my head goes. It's like, wow, this is a very... It's kind of a model of society. We don't always get to say, hey, it should be this way, but...
Yes, and that's the thing. Let's negotiate this. Mm-hmm. It's always... When they want to come and talk to me about their grade, I always try really hard to find, even if it's just the most minute thing, I always try to find a reason to change the grade.
For the better.
Mm-hmm. For the better. Because that's a scary thing. And I don't tell them that if you come to see me, I'm going to automatically change your grade. I don't think they need to know that. It's just a principle of my own. Because if they can come to me and they're willing to come to me, and instead of coming to me and saying, I don't know why I got this grade. It really wasn't very fair that I got this grade and I did everything that you told me to do and I didn't. Instead, if they come to me and they go, I've been looking over this and right here, when you ask this question, it's kind of not a clear question. When they say stuff like that to me, I'm all over it. So it's like, okay, tell me why you think it isn't a clear question. How can I word it better to make it clear? And I get really good stuff that way. And so... they need to feel that when they leave my class, they've been heard. And so sometimes I'm talking to them for a really long time before they'll give me something that says, it's okay, yeah, I can make this change. And even if it's just a point or two, that may change for them from a minus to, from a B minus to a B. And that means a lot to them. And so... So I think that that's important, and that is a life skill. Able to go in and negotiate and explain to somebody why you think the policy at work is not fair or unclear, and not be intimidated by the person that you're talking to, that's a huge skill.
And the ability, asking for help, I think, is actually a huge life skill as well. And, as a librarian, we're always kind of trying to train students to ask for help, in part because that's the way our model is set up, for better or worse. I can tell it takes a lot of guts sometimes for a student. I'll see them in the library again and again and again, and then one day they finally get to the desk, and it it's just really amazing and magical when they realize that asking for help really can be. And in myself, too, there are times where I'm sort of fighting it, and I'm like, oh, I can just ask for help. Oh, this is going to get easier. It's a life skill.
It's empowering, I think. I think it's empowering. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a downside to inquiry-based learning, and that's if you have students in class who they're just not motivated, and it doesn't matter what you say or what you do, they're not going to do the work. That's a tough one. That's a tough one because then it's, how is your behavior going to impact these other people? And when I see that happening in class, usually the third unit, I'll say, okay, you've been in the same group for two units. I'm mixing the groups up now. And then usually I take all of those people and I put them in one group so that they can really feel what it's like to not have somebody that's going to pull them along. And that's a huge learning experience for them as well. It's painful. It's painful sometimes. It's painful for me sometimes as a teacher because sometimes I just let them fail. And that's not a very popular line of thinking in our culture these days. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important because if I'm willing to try something and I'm willing to fail if it doesn't work, I have to be willing to let the students fail. I don't think we do them any justice by coddling them and by pushing them and by helping them if they're not willing to help themselves.
Absolutely. A quick question. Before you switched to inquiry-based teaching, have you noticed a difference in students coming to your office hours? Part of the reason I ask is some other instructors I've been talking to, they're like, no one ever comes to office hours. Students just don't seem to want to use them. They don't understand what they're for, or they just don't care. I mean, have you noticed?
I had one of my students the other day say that the first time she went to a professor's office was to come to my office, and that was because I was making her come to my office. Everybody had to come, but she said it was the very first time, and I said, well, really, you know, your instructors all probably have office hours. Mm-hmm. You can
secure yeah.
Well, I wouldn't want to bother them.
See, and I do think that's it. I don't think it's that they don't know how to use them mm-hmm. or what they're for. I think it's a mental thing with them that I shouldn't bother them. I don't want to bother them. And it's also really scary to ask for help. It's not like, you know, they just are very much afraid of that. And have I seen a switch in that? I would say no, not really. It's kind of the same. And that is just, I really think it's a mentality thing. I tell them, you know, now that you're in college, one of the biggest things that you need to do is to communicate with your professors. And so whether that's coming to my office and doing it or sending me an email or calling me at home, I don't give them my cell number, but call me at home, you need to communicate with me. There is so much more I can do if I know you're having an issue up front than if you wait and come in to me from behind. Mm-hmm. Then the assignments are done, you've missed it, it's late work. I can't, in order to be fair to people in the class, I can't give exceptions. But I have workarounds up front. So I talk to them a lot about learning to communicate with your professors and being able to communicate with them. But I think that's just a thing of where they're just scared to do that. And nobody's told them it's okay.
And what about attendance? Have you noticed a change in attendance?
Huge. It's huge for me.
What do you attribute your attendance to? Is it the inquiry-based learning, the fact that they are in control of things, or is it more to do with the fact that they're in groups, or maybe sort of a combination of the two?
It's a combination of the two. What they know is everything that happens before they go into group, they're going to need in the group. So whether it's watching a movie, because in my class that's one of the things that I do, because concepts that I teach are real personal, and people aren't so willing to talk about their own self-concept in class, but they'll look at somebody on the screen and talk about their self-concept. So it's just a different way of getting at the concept. So we watch a movie, and then every day at the beginning of the unit, that's what we're doing. So I do like this little 15-minute lecture about this particular concept. And so when you watch the movie today, I want you to watch for this, and I want you to watch for that. And then we watch the movie, and then there's a little about 5 minutes after where we kind of talk about, so when you saw this happening, what was going on really? And so they have some time to talk about that. So they know that that whole thing is getting them ready for their take-home or their movie analysis questions. The movie analysis questions are giving them the foundation that they need in order to be a good group member when they come in. So they see that everything ties together, everything relates. But in the end, I think it's because it's a combination of the fact that they have a large say in what happens in the classroom, also because they're going to be working in groups, and so there's a lot more interaction that happens in class. They're not just sitting there. And also because they know they need the information for the group. So they see how it all fits together. And when they see how it all fits together, then the buy-in is bigger. So, and I also have, I also have a harsh attendance policy, I'm told. Which may, you know, I mean, I give them three.
But you probably had that harsh attendance policy before.
I did.
And
it didn't matter.
But yeah. Whereas now it seems to help. Maybe for those.
Yeah.
Less inclined to be a part of the groups, but they still want those attendance points. So.
Yeah. Because at the end, none of them, they know that at the end they have to stand up and speak in front of the class. And none of them want to do that and look silly or stupid. And so they come. And they know that the only way they can not look silly and stupid is if they participate in the group. It's not like they can just come to class and sleep through class and then go and do the work on their own and then come and present. They have to know what's going on in class in order to share with the group. And they have to share with the group in order to really understand what it is they're talking about in the presentation. And that is a life skill. None of us would participate in it, I would hope, would participate in a panel or in a presentation if we didn't know what we were talking about. So it's a good thing for them to learn. Yeah, it's painful.
It's awkward, too. Yeah.
It's painful.
Yeah.
It's painful because in the beginning with the first unit, yeah, they don't get that message. And so they're standing up there and I'm going, oh, this is horrible. This is horrible. But when that presentation is over, there's just this huge shift that happens in the classroom.
It's interesting, dude, because every time I hear you talk about it, you know, it's, you say, you know, again, students were willing to skip class when it was just you they were accountable to, but when they're accountable to their group and others, they show up, when they're accountable to themselves, as in, you know, gosh, I don't want to look stupid, I don't, you know, it's a reputation thing, so there's just a whole aspect of tapping into some sort of social motivation there that I suspect, from listening to you talk, seems to be going on.
Yeah.
It also helps that your classes tend to be pretty fun and you watch the documentary about Metallica and Lars and the Real Girl, and it sounds like you change your movies up and
keep them
culturally fresh.
I try. Because that, you know, it's like they all really enjoyed the movie on Metallica, but they were really glad when we were done. And that's how it should be, because what that means is we've talked about that movie so much and we've analyzed what's happening in that group for so much that they're ready to move on. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. So, you know, that's, and I tease them about that. But their question is always, what movie are we going to watch with this unit? You know, so they like the, I think. You know, I always have a class a semester that isn't so fond of groups and really it's painful and, you know, but they hang in. You know, and manage to, by the end of the semester, they have an appreciation for group. They're never going to love it, and that's okay, but they have an appreciation. Those people are people that I have trouble trusting other people. That's kind of what I've just realized lately. People that, they really believe just very honestly that nobody can do it better than I can. Mm. and I don't want somebody else being responsible for my grade, those are the people that have a really hard time with group work. And they just... So then we have a discussion about if that's really how you feel, what can you bring to the group or help with the group so that everybody in the group is willing to have the same buy-in. And that's when we talk about the importance of group goals over individual goals.
You know, it's so interesting. Back in my days at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, we had a nonprofit leadership institute, and we read this man named Marty Linsky and Ron Heifetz, who are some kind of leading leadership thinkers, and they tell a lot of stories about leadership at the corporate level and reasons, you know, people everyone thought would succeed would fail. And there's a very interesting story about a man who was very high up in, or worked his way up through the Coca-Cola company. Maybe in the show notes, I know Alan's looking at me like I've just gone completely insane, but it's an interesting story. He works his way up through Coke. He's very competent. He puts in long hours. He works by himself, and he's just the shining rising star. And he makes it all the way to the top, and I don't remember if he's the CFO or the CEO or something. And he continues the work habits he's always had once he's at the highest level of leadership, which is, I'm going to work alone, I take on all the responsibility myself, I put in all the hours. And he fails horribly, stock goes down, the board is dissatisfied, and he's out within a year. And in their analysis, it's all about that kind of working alone, where there's no empowering of others, and it's, you just, there's a point at which you can't take it all on yourself anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually, just from a leadership and self-growth perspective, we can't all always do it all on our own. So it's an interesting kind of parallel to a different part of my life. But I think that in some ways we are teaching students to be leaders in different, even if you're, you know, just a normal person within a normal business, the ability to say, to call out, you know, things that are difficult or not working well,
right.
I think.
Right.
So it is really, I think, a lifelong learning skill to teach in that way.
Yeah. But to actually say, I'm going to teach you how to be a good group member, because you're going to need it later on in life.
Yeah,
they would be really. It would be like, oh, I am so sleeping through this class. So, you know, and that's, I think, for me, is what started it all. I had more and more students coming to my class and sitting at the back with their head cocked against the wall, and I'm like, up there turning cartwheels and all kinds of things. I was just like, okay, something's got to change.
There's cupcakes up here, folks.
Yeah, really? Pizza, pizza, pizza! You know? And they're just, you know, something had to change. And so, but like I said, I didn't do it all at once. It's very much been a progression.
Do you notice any difference with the group members between introverts and extroverts?
Mm-hmm.
Is one more the successful in the group than the other?
No. And I talk about that in my class a lot. And I usually talk about it at the beginning so that they recognize the quality that each of those personalities bring. And it's kind of nice because I know you probably wouldn't know this, but I'm an extrovert. And I'm married to a man who is very much an introvert. And so we talk about that, really, the difference in the two is, it's not that one is better than the other. It's really how people process information. And that people that are extroverts, we have to talk because that's how we process our thoughts. That's how we process information. Introverts process all inside. And when they speak, they're not thinking anymore. They're done thinking, and this is what they think. And those of us that are extroverts will start with a sentence, and 20 minutes later, we may end up with what we think, but we don't know that. So it can be misleading. And so we talk about the importance of both, that an introvert is somebody that's going to just do a lot of listening, and they're going to contemplate the issues that are going on. Extroverts are people that are going to bring energy to the group, and you're going to need that energy. And the extrovert is the person that will get the group going and thinking. But when it comes time for the two to work, the ideas that come across from the extrovert are no better than the introvert that has not talked for 15 minutes and says something in two. And you just sit there and you go, that is so right. That is a really good thought. And so we talk about that. And it's important for me because I think lots of times there is a misconception that people that are introverts, they're not paying attention. Are you with the program? You're not talking. Are you with? Can you give me something to go? Give me something. Just a little something.
You've been off the quiet.
Yeah, you know, it's like, all right, hello. Are you sleeping? And so it just gets them to kind of think. And it's interesting because they'll go, and what I know is whatever type I'm talking about, that's the type that they are. When they open their mouths and they're nodding their heads going, oh, yeah, I know, you know. And then we talk about that, how those two types make decisions, because that's a huge thing for groups, you know. If you're an extrovert, you want to talk and talk and talk about this decision. And the introvert over here, they've already made the decision. They've done the whole thing in their head. And so when they say, let's go out for dinner, they mean, let's go out for dinner. It's not, let's go out for dinner, or maybe we could stay home, or, you know. And that's the example that I use in my class, because Chuck and I have that in our lives all the time. I'll say, you want to go out for dinner? And he'll say, sure. And so then to him, the decision has been made that we're going out for dinner. And I'm still thinking, well, we could go out for dinner, or we could stay at home, we could grill, we could, and he'll just, you know.
He's already putting on his shoes. And
yeah, and he's ready to go, and I'm not there yet, because I haven't really decided, you know. So that's an important thing, is it's not that one is better in a group than the other, it's the ability to appreciate what they both bring to the group, and they're very valuable. They're very valuable.
So, Alan, can I ask you a question then? As perhaps at times someone who favors the introvert, as we've discussed, I think actually on this podcast as well. Because when I work with Jane and I talk with Jane, I'm very open, and I'm very open with her students too. I didn't like doing group work. It was painful for me, in part because I am introverted, in part because all of the things that I know your students hate about group work, some people do more work, some people do less work. So hearing Jane talk about this kind of group work, I mean, what does that set off for you as maybe someone who doesn't always enjoy...
Huge red flags. I don't know. I have had problems with group work, and I think for maybe two reasons. One, you've just illuminated for me, I think, not being... Well, in part because introverts are oftentimes pulled into an extroverted mode that isn't very comfortable. And sometimes that happens from the instructor themselves doing things like, why are you being so quiet, and making them feel even more badly about being who they are. And then another times, I think, an issue that I've had with group work is maybe not related to my introverted personality, but probably related to my perfectionism personality. So I'd be one of those people in your groups who really wants... who doesn't necessarily trust the other people to get it right, mm-hmm. and who really wants to get it right and get it very precise. And I think I'm pretty good about giving up that control, but I think there's still a tendency to wish I didn't have to. Mm. And so working in groups makes me have to give up that control, and then it's a little disconcerting to me personally. But
so the question is that instead of giving up the control, why... do you hold others accountable for that piece? That's one of the things that I challenge my students. It's, well, you know, what if we don't get it done right? What if you don't get it done right? The question I'm going to ask you is, why didn't you get it done right? Why did you let Joe sit over here and not do anything? Because Joe is going to get the same grade as you. You who's done 80 to 85% of the work. So why are you not saying to Joe, Joe, step up or you're getting out, you know? So
that's... This is so not a Midwestern way of working, Jane. Come on.
No, it is not. It's not. And you can see the students go, we can do that? And I said, of course you can. Because in real life, when you're in a corporation or a company, how long do you think you're going to be in that company if people keep doing the work for you? Pretty soon it's going to... You may get to stay there, but you're not going to have a lot of respect. And when you don't have a lot of respect in your company, you're really not going to go anywhere. You're not going to be very successful. And so you're not going to end up being not happy.
So that works for the students who aren't doing the work, but what about the people who are doing the 85%?
Yeah, so it's kind of, it
that's
kind of
the challenge.
Leads me to be that guy who then picks up Joe's slack.
Yeah.
Yes, but that's the challenge. Yeah. And that's the challenge is you have to challenge yourself to say to Joe, Joe, I'm not feeling because of you. So you're going to come over here on Tuesday night and you're going to work with me and I'm going to show you how to do this. That's one of the things that Google Docs has done.
What's that?
It's allowed the students to, and me, to actually see who's doing the work. One of the things that I put into place after hearing you talk was I have them color code. So if you're typing, you're purple, and if you're typing, you're orange, and you're typing, you're yellow. Mm. So I can actually see who's doing most of the work. And instead of me going to that group and saying, we got one person over here who's doing the work for everybody, I say to that person, you need to stop that. So when you come to your group, you need to have a discussion about, remember that accountability piece? How are you holding everybody in the group accountable?
Brilliant.
No, but interesting.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay, interesting.
Yes.
Ongoing willingness to experiment, which I think is just amazing and refreshing, in part because I worry that I have a tendency to, like, I'll figure this out once and then I'll get to do it the same. And, I mean, I'm obviously not a classroom teacher, so I don't really have to worry about it, but it's just a...
Well, don't you, though? I guess that was going to be my question for you, Nicole, was could you worry about, could you do some inquiry-based learning as part of library services, and mm-hmm. would there be an element of could that, or does it have to happen over time, Jane, in your experience?
No.
Can it be a tight-knit kind of experience for students?
So we've actually started doing something. You know, I think since I've only been an academic librarian for full-time for a year and a half, we used to do this thing where we'd give students a tour of the library. Every librarian hates doing it, and the students hate it. It's obvious when you watch them, either if you're giving the tour or someone else's, they feel awkward because you're sort of on display in a big public place. And we, like, shuffle them, like, look at the reference desk. And then we shuffle them to the periodicals, look at the magazines. And they're like, oh, my gosh, I have eyes. Thank you. I can see. But, you know, instructors really want this tour of the library. And it's actually against, I think, our professional ethos of the library is your space. You learn at your speed what you want to learn. So what I started doing, and it was, as soon as I thought of it, I was like, this is so obvious, why haven't we been doing this forever? When instructors really insist upon having a tour and having their students in the space, which is fine, they come and I say, hi, welcome to the library, this is your space, go explore, we'll meet in the classroom in 5 minutes and tell me what we have. And it actually makes a huge difference because they come back and they tell me hilarious things. They'll be like, the library has a great view of the windmill. And then everyone laughs, right, because they think they're not supposed to say that. And I say, you're right, we do have an awesome view. You can go sit up there and study anytime you want. That's your space. And they come back and they talk, and they've never talked in my instruction sessions. They're always quiet. They're excited. And it starts off those kind of dreaded one-shot sessions really, really well. And then my end goal for teaching how to use databases, which is deadly. Nobody wants to sit and watch me click through a database, and I don't want to sit and click through a database because it's maddening. And I heard about this at a library conference, and I've tried it once, is to have students, you know, I'd sort of be like, here's what this database does, here's what this one does. Now you guys use it, and then you'll teach it to us. And then I can chime in with things like when they're like, well, I found this article, but I couldn't read it. You know, I could talk to them about the concept of citation versus full text. You know, and that some people research using citations first at advanced levels of research. But I do think, ultimately, we're aiming towards getting the librarian out of the front of the room clicking through a database, because that's just deadly. It is.
It is.
And one of our challenges is our technological setup. The one lab where I was able to do that was a full computer lab. It had AB Tutor on it. So I actually had the students race. I was like, first one to find an article on GIS, and I think it was like wolf tracking. Let me know. And so they were all like looking and like, what's this and what's that? And then they got so excited, and then we pulled up their article. And, like, to get students excited about researching in an academic database, like, nothing could be more boring, and they were so thrilled. And I was so thrilled. And I don't have any formal data to back it up, but I think it sticks better. Because it's one thing to watch someone mouse around a screen. It's another thing to do it yourself. And because research, by and large, happens alone at your computer screen, it's an awfully hard thing to teach. So we are aiming for it, but we're not quite as much there as...
Well, I think that is one of the things about that is good about inquiry-based learning is I think you can do as little or as much as you want to. Mm-hmm. When I first started, I just did one activity. And then I just built from there. And then I did a couple. And then I did three or four. And then after that, then I did a unit. Just one unit. And then, so it, I think you, you know, and it isn't for everybody because of some of the things that we've talked before about. You have to be willing to let go of the control of the classroom. You can't be afraid to fail and to make mistakes and to look dumb in front of the students. You can't be afraid of that. And that's an uncomfortable place for a lot of people. So it's not for everybody. But I think if you can use little bits of it, give them a taste of it, I think then it's a good thing. So I really think anybody could use it. And I think a lot of the assignments, really, they just kind of need to go at it backwards, you know, instead of that if they just look at it and say, what is it that I want them to know? After they do this activity, what is the main thing that I want them to know? And if you can identify that and then turn it into a question, then, you know, that's pretty much inquiry-based learning, I think.
So just maybe as a last question for me, Alan, so in teaching Chinese, like what does this make you think about your own teaching? Or do you do things like this, or does it not really feel like it translates to language?
Well, there are activities in class where I do ask them to prepare outside of class, so when they come to class, they're kind of ready to interact with each other. It's more partner-based learning than it is team-based. Mm-hmm. But it is. But they should be ready. And I do struggle, though, or maybe they struggle. Maybe we all struggle with staying on task in those partners in those groups. So some of them will be really prepared, and they'll get together in their little pair, and they'll share, they'll interact, they'll ask the question and come up with a response. They may translate something, and then they stop and they shut down, and that's as far as they'll go because they don't ask that next question. They don't go on to whatever next logical step might be to keep practicing the language. So they just kind of sit there, or they'll chat, and so that's where I am right now with kind of, well, if you call it flipping a classroom, or if you call it some other model by some other name. But yeah, I guess that's where I am at this point.
My response to that might. I don't necessarily think that there's anything wrong with that. Because one of the things that we talk about in groups when we teach group communication is that there really are two dimensions to every group. There's the task and there's the social dimension. And sometimes we get so focused on the task that the social dimension falls apart. And a group really then is ineffective. I mean, they get the task accomplished, but they generally don't operate as a group. They operate as four individuals doing their own thing. And here we're going to present. And that's very different than being an effective group. And so the social element needs to be there. So when my students, if they're in class and they have finished the agenda for the day and they're just hanging out talking, I leave them alone. And there are times where I will even encourage them to not come to class, to meet away from class, because then they're in an entirely different environment and I'm not around, and so it changes it completely. So I think that having that social chit-chat time is an important piece, but there are a lot of professors that would not be okay with that.
And I guess the chit-chat doesn't bother me nearly as much as the sitting there doing twiddling their thumbs.
Yeah. Mm.
Where I'm like, well, maybe they're thinking about something. But give them the benefit of the doubt. But sometimes I'm like, well, couldn't you be doing a little something else?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that's good to challenge them, though.
Right.
And to say, okay, so if you finish that, let's take this one step further. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? Or, you know, how might you use this? Or, I don't know.
Well, thank you guys so much. It's been so fun. Alan and Jane, much appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to turn off my radio voice and say I gotta head towards daycare to pick up my little one. So.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone.